This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 3rd of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Rylan, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, I'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, The Dory House, The Monocle Daily, and The Ten. Coming up on the show, with the UN General Assembly this past week, we had analysis of the highs and, of course, the lows.
There's a story about Mohamed El-Baradei, the former head of the IAEA, who was once asked about his job, and he said, well, my wife is a kindergarten teacher, and we have pretty much the same job when it comes right down to it.
Then, all week, we explored the role of the television talk show. We head to Scandinavia to hear from one of Sweden's top talents. And later in the program, a weekly roundup of the top news from the luxury industry.
The hospitality industry in particular, through sites such as TripAdvisor, has struggled. You know, who are the people on TripAdvisor? Do we care about their opinion? Are they the people that really understand and appreciate luxury brands?
All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Ben Rylan. Welcome to the program. Starting off, we're in the UN, where the General Assembly last week gathered some of the biggest names in global politics. Held at the UN headquarters in New York, all eyes and ears were tuned to Barack Obama, who was addressing the General Assembly for the seventh time, and Vladimir Putin, who was there for the first time in 10 years. Both leaders gave strong speeches, critical of each other's foreign policy, before meeting privately on the sidelines. Georgina Godwin spoke with Dr. Jacob Parakilis, Assistant Project Director at the US Project at Chatham House, on Tuesday's edition of The Globalist. They opened the discussion with Obama's speech.
He was blunt in the way that members of Congress are often blunt. There are rules that prevent them from saying specific things. So he said certain countries, and it was very clear who he was talking about, but there was an interesting sort of dance around not saying Vladimir Putin, I'm calling you out, you know, I'm calling Iran out, I'm calling China out. It was entirely specific, but without that sort of final element of specificity. And he basically said that you can't have a rules-based international order, you can't have an aspiration to democracy without also sort of giving up on this idea of using force to redefine state boundaries or to, I think he used the phrase might makes right and said it was an element of the past, but clearly that's not really the case.
He was very strong on Syria and Assad.
Yes. And he renewed the US call for Assad to leave power as part of a broader political settlement. Of course, Russia has a long-standing military and political relationship with Assad and with the Syrian regime generally, so that didn't go over well with Putin. And of course, there was the sort of the middle school level antics continued. Putin arranged his timing, so he arrived just as Obama's speech was ending. And then when Putin took the stand, suddenly in the U.S. section of the seat, it was just junior officials.
And all sorts of things with sort of not smiling when they were clinking glasses and various other really childish actions, it has to be said.
There's a story about Mohamed El-Baradei, the former head of the IAEA, who was once asked about his job, and he said, well, my wife is a kindergarten teacher, and we have pretty much the same job when it comes right down to it.
Let's look at what Putin said in his speech.
Yeah, Putin basically said that the Syrian military and the Syrian government had been fighting terrorism face-to-face, which I suppose is true if you consider dropping barrel bombs and chemical weapons on civilian populations, fighting face-to-face. But he essentially said that the Syrian government was the best hope against militant Islam, that he had signed a cooperation agreement with Iran, Iraq, Syria to sort of increase intelligence sharing and cooperation against ISIS and other radical groups, and that this was the bulwark for the West. Mm-hmm. He's trying to cast himself in sort of terms that might be familiar from the war on terror.
These sentiments that they both expressed in their speeches, were those carried through into the private meeting?
It's not really clear. I mean, the public rhetoric and private rhetoric are likely to be very different. And frankly, there are common interests, and Putin alluded to that afterwards. The problem is that you have two people who, at least on the surface, have very fundamentally different conceptions of the world. Putin believes very strongly in realpolitik and doesn't really bother to hide it. Obama also believes in realpolitik, but to a much lesser degree, and he has to sort of hide it under a sheen of liberal internationalism, which he also does believe in. So, you know, Putin has the advantage of sort of saying what he believes and believing what he says. I mean, absent the whole shamelessness of saying we're not in Crimea, we're just defending legitimate government in Syria, he can be relatively consistent, whereas Obama has a much more complicated philosophical and political set of values that he has to hold in his head and reconcile at the same time. But by contrast, Obama also has much more power in terms of national implement. So there is some scope for reconciliation there. And there is a shared enemy. I mean, neither the US nor Russia wants anything to do with ISIS and wants ISIS to be rolled back. The problem is, to what extent do you collaborate with a government that has committed horrific war crimes in order to make that happen?
And Russia now saying that it's going to join an alliance of intelligence sharing with various people that the United States disapproves of.
Well, with some people the United States disapproves of, particularly the government of Iran, and some that it basically approves of, such as the government of Iraq. I mean, this is one of those things where if you tried to draw a map of the alliances and hatreds, you would end up with a sort of indistinguishable squiggle, because there's just so much complexity in terms of allies, enemies, frenemies, to bring back the middle school terminology, that it's almost impossible for anyone to sort of have a consistent policy unless you're willing to completely abandon any pretense of adherence to that rules-based international order that Obama was talking about.
That was Dr. Jacob Parakilis there, Assistant Project Director for the US Project at Chatham House, on Tuesday's edition of The Globalist with Georgina Godwin. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Now, on Tuesday's edition of Midori House, Steve Bloomfield discussed the day's top issues with regular Monocle 24 contributors Alessio Patilano and Martin Plout. We continued our coverage of the UN General Assembly with a look at Italy's Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi. As part of an interview that touched upon the country's stance in the Middle East and even reforms in the nation's Senate, Renzi said that if Western leaders want to end the carnage in Syria, they must accept the central role of Russia in world affairs. Does he have a point?
There's no way that the Russians, who are a major world force, can be ignored. And I think that this was one of the mistakes at the end of the Cold War, is that the Americans thought, we've won. In fact, said so. They said, we've won. There is only one superpower. No, there aren't. There are at least two superpowers. And in fact, power is draining away to three superpowers. And the third one is, of course, China.
Our China and Russia, sorry, I don't really want to get into our China and Russia superpowers, but come on, they're not really, are they? They're regional powers.
No, I don't agree. I think that they are superpowers. They have an ability to project themselves and are increasingly projecting themselves across the world.
Can I just take the middle ground here? And I'd say that they're not necessarily a regional power because they do have a political influence and economic influence that yields far beyond their regional, immediate regions. But I wouldn't call them global because I don't think at the moment they have a clear ability to sustain political economic influence and impose costs on people that don't respect it with military means as yet.
I just want to ask you, Alessio, about Renzi making these comments about Russia and Russia's role. Italy's stance towards Russia, it's fair to say, has been a bit more nuanced than, you know, countries further west, you know, the UK and the US in particular. Why do you think that is?
I think, first of all, there's the personal element to it. Matteo Renzi has been presenting himself all across the political landscape in Italy and in Europe as the kind of guy that will not hold it back, will tell you things just up front. That's part of his strategy. That's how he's likable. He's also relatively young, so he's almost allowed to say things that other people cannot do and say. And so in this respect, as you said, Steve, is it telling the sort of a lie? No, he isn't. I mean, one has to take Russia back into that diplomatic discussion. And the fact that we waited too long, we're paying now the consequences of military assets already being deployed in Syria. So I think that's one of the elements. But there's something more to that. And I think it transcends Renzi's own persona. And that goes to a certain understanding in Italy based on relatively strong ties. During the Cold War, the Italian Communist Party was one of the strongest and most connected Communist parties Marxist communist movement. And even before that, I mean, you can go back the early sort of very special relationship between the Italian and the Soviets. They date back in the 1920s when Stalin fell in love with Italian cruisers and had Italian architects going back to Soviet naval bases and work with dockyards. And from then, we see even from British records that Italian intelligence on the Soviet Union was quite good. And as a result of that, you have this political, economic, long-term ties being developed. And as a result of that, I suppose also an appreciation of how far the sort of Soviet and Russian tentacles can reach out in certain regions of the world, Middle East being one that is very close to Italians' interests.
That was a highlight there from Tuesday's edition of Midori House. Now it's time for a highlight from the Monocle Daily. On Monday, Andrew Miller and Dominic Reynolds checked in with Monocle's North American Bureau to see what's making headlines in that part of the world. We spoke with Ed Stocker, Monocle's New York Bureau Chief, and Thomas Lewis, Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief. Kicking it all off was Ed Stocker, as plans were announced to provide free lawyers for tenants fighting illegal evictions in New York's housing courts.
Homelessness is actually going up. It's actually gone up from 50,000 to 57,000 from January 2014 to September of this year. So this is trying to tackle that issue by taking some measures, I guess. The lawyers are there to help avoid evictions from housing. And this kind of plays into gentrification as well, but not entirely. But part of the reason, you know, neighborhoods changing, rents becoming more expensive, people being priced out, people not being able to keep up with rents and then being evicted. A figure released by the city claims that 32% of families that are homeless or in shelters have actually been evicted. So that's almost a third. That's a pretty high percentage. So the reckoning is that if you can get lawyers, if you can get justice or you know, the men in suits to help you out, stop you getting evicted, it can avoid this issue. But it's part of an overall plan, I guess, to increase funding for what is a very serious problem. You know, you do see people homeless, like you do in many big cities, on the streets. But the issue is the fact that the numbers aren't going down. And also at the same time, apparently, people are spending longer in shelters. So putting pressure on the shelter system as well in those two ways.
And we leap across now to Thomas Lewis, Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief. This is a new smartphone from BlackBerry, which I think to many might be outstripped by a bigger story here, which is that BlackBerry's still going.
Yes, that's not an unfair summary, I think. So the CEO of BlackBerry was sort of forced into a corner on Friday, really. There were rumours that they were working on this new handset and various leaks emerged at the end of last week, which brought him to announce the PRIV, which is short for privacy. This is BlackBerry's new handset, which has a keyboard, but is also has a curved screen, a touch screen, of course. Now, one of the big complaints about BlackBerry's handsets in the past has been limited options for apps, and that being such a growing industry that when you buy a smartphone, you're going to buy it primarily maybe so you can have plenty of apps to play with it. Now, they're hoping that by hooking up with Google Play will give them a huge raft of apps from which users can use, that will fill that gap in the market. Now, of course, you know, many people are looking at BlackBerry and the decline of its handset business. I spoke to a journalist for Bloomberg here in Toronto a little earlier today who said, well, actually, you know, things aren't too good. The stock price for BlackBerry dropped when they revealed this new handset on Friday. But actually, the CEO has been buying up all these other software companies. And that's where I think BlackBerry is hoping its profits will come from rather than the handset. Now, of course, the public image of BlackBerry will rest pretty heavily, I'd say, on how the PRIV does.
Thomas Lewis in Toronto and Ed Stocker in New York there with Monocle's Dominic Reynolds and Andrew Miller on Monday's edition of the Monocle Daily. Up next, the TV talk show in Sweden, a new car for Tesla and luxury hotels.
Kiosk Cafe has arrived in London. From the founders of Monocle comes a newsstand and coffee bar concept inspired by Europe's finest city street kiosks. There's a great selection of magazines and newspapers, of course, including print-on-demand titles from all around the world, making Kiosk Cafe in Paddington a real celebration of the best in print and paper. And there's more. With all-pressed coffee and travel essentials from some of Monocle's favorite brands available, too, Kiosk Cafe is the perfect spot for business travelers and visitors to London, as well as print aficionados. Come and visit us and see for yourself. Kiosk Cafe is open for business now from 7 a.m. to 1900 daily at Norfolk Place, moments from Paddington Station. Kiosk Cafe, newsstand and coffee bar. We look forward to welcoming you.
You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted right here at Midori House. I'm Ben Rylan. The format may have evolved, but the love of live television is still as strong as ever. 61 years ago this week, America's NBC network aired the very first edition of The Tonight Show. And if the current rush by major networks to debut new live programs is any indication, we just might be set for another golden age. Well, all this week on The Globalist, we were exploring the TV talk show, and one particular interview stood out. We'll go to Scandinavia now, where host Fredrik Skavlan entertains viewers not only in his native Norway, but in neighbouring Sweden too, with his eponymously named show. Here, he explains the challenges involved when putting together such a programme.
My name is Fredrik Skavlan. I'm the host of Skavlan, which is a Friday night talk show airing prime time in Sweden and Norway. We cover most topics. I mean, we have guests from politics, from entertainment, from culture, from sports, from science. This is a classic Scandinavian talk show format. I speak Norwegian, but I only have to change a few words and then a Swede would understand what I'm saying. I speak Norwegian, Swedish, and I speak English, or broken English, whatever you call it. And that's the way we do it in Scandinavia.
Det är en fråga, och där får vi höra mer musik.
Alltså, jag har lärt mig att aldrig säga aldrig, för det vet man inte. Men jag tycker att jag börjar komma upp I en ålder nu där man kanske tar det lite lugnare.
We speak English when we're asked to. We like to speak English. And as soon as I get an English-speaking guest on, we will all be, you know, switched to our version of English. The big challenge with airing in two countries that actually know very little about the other is that your audience haven't got the same references. So you really leave your bubble. And I was working for 9 years with this Norwegian show, and it was a huge success, but I was in a bubble. And I thought that everybody knew the same references that I had. And it's not like that anymore, and probably wasn't then either, but I really have to focus on story. I mean, even a celebrity can be a celebrity only in one of the countries. So then I have to find something to talk about that captures the viewer and keeps the viewer there. The format is quite unique, actually. It's very simple, but it's quite unique because it merges these very different worlds, you know? It's not like an entertainment show, because you have a lot of talk shows, especially Friday night talk shows, which will be hosted by comedians. I'm not a comedian, I'm a journalist. We have a lot of laughs there, because we have funny guests and funny questions and funny answers. But still, we can also go very deep, and we can have very serious conversations, like when we have Malala on, you know?
We said that without struggle and without speaking up for our rights and without speaking up for peace, we are never going to see peace in our life. So the best way to fight against the terrorism was to speak. People told us that, are you not afraid of death? Living in that kind of situation when there are terrorists all around you, they are going to kill you. So it's good to speak and then be killed. So that's what I prefer.
Or when we have a serious politician or something like that. What we do is that we mix all this together. So a typical show would perhaps open with an in-depth interview with some very famous person in Scandinavia. And then we will have maybe one more Scandinavian on from the current news or something. And then we will have an international scientist or something. We have a lot of international science on, people that we find on, you know, TED Talks and that sort of guests. We wrap it up by having an international star. I mean, last year we had Kanye West on, we've had Alicia Keys, we've had Rihanna. So that's typical format. But I think the most interesting part of the format is that, I mean, I'm not the most interesting person in the room. If I can make the guests interact that will be the highlight of the show.
There's not an angle you can get. They're always, all animals are unconditionally beautiful and perfect. But
it makes me like you more that you like animals.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Yeah.
Thank you. If you just saw that, you'd think there's not an angle.
Yeah. Do I like this guy?
But he loves animals. Oh!
If you asked me 10 years ago, I would say a great guest is a guest that talks a lot, but that's not true. I mean, I like difficult guests, actually. I like guests that are challenging me, guests that are not accepting the format right away and not accepting my plan, you know. My favorite there is Robbie Williams, the British singer. He's been on like 5 or 6 times. And he's really been a favorite guest because I think he loves this format and the way he just takes over in a way, and we interact in a great way.
But when you come off stage, you're not wandering around the house going, I'm loving angels instead, let me entertain you.
When we had Bill Gates on, we asked him to play chess, just a game of chess for 3 minutes, you know, with the world champion Magnus Carlsen. That was like a YouTube clip that went 4 million in 2 days. It was a big deal because that's how you promote TV programs today, because even traditional television is now old media.
Oh, that was quick. Oh, that was bad.
That was Fredrik Skavlan there, Swedish TV host extraordinaire, speaking on The Globalist. This is The Recap on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Rylan. Well, off to Silicon Valley now, where electric car maker Tesla has just unveiled its third car, the Model X, which is a sports utility vehicle. It fits 7 people and can travel 400 kilometres on a single charge. But the best thing of all, apparently, are its so-called Falcon wing doors, which open upwards. Steve Fowler is editor-in-chief of Auto Express and Car Buyer, and he spoke to Monocle's Tighe Enright on Thursday's edition of The Globalist.
I must admit, does the world need a car with Falcon doors? Probably not, but when Elon Musk and Tesla decide to do something, they like to do things a little bit different. You're right, the DeLorean, famous car with gullwing doors, these are slightly different because they're double-hinged. The problem that everybody was talking about with these doors is what happens if you're in a car park and you're parked close to the car next to you where you've got a low ceiling. Now, these are so clever, these doors, that they've got a double hinge, so they open up without opening out, if that makes sense. They've also got ultrasonic sensors, so if they sense anything above or below, they will stop. Now, you might say this all adds to the cost of the car, but of course it all adds to the desirability of the Tesla too.
Very good. Well, it seems like they've solved the DeLorean question. What about other technological breakthroughs with the car? The fact that it can carry so many people and travel so far on a single charge, what does that mean for e-car technology?
Well, Tesla has really been leading the way in terms of range. Think about most electric cars. You can buy things like the Renault Zoe, Nissan Leaf, there's a Kia Soul as well. You rarely do more than 100 miles on a full charge in those sort of cars. Of course, the Tesla's batteries are very different, much more expensive, much more battery density involved and weight. But you're right, you can go a very long way in these cars, and that's really, really appealing. The Tesla Model S led the way with that. The Tesla Model X also has the 17-inch touchscreen, which controls everything in the car, very minimalist interior. You're right, it seats 7 people because it can actually, those doors, the good thing about those doors is they give you a nice wide opening, so it's very easy to get into a third row of seats. But there's also other technology, a lot of technology that help the car drive itself, autonomous driving, so the car can pretty much drive itself on the freeway, on the motorways. Obviously, you've got to be stay in control as well. My favorite device of all is the bioweapon defense mode. Now, big problem for emissions is not only emissions outside the car, but what comes into a car. And Tesla has fitted 2 fancy air filters, which filters the air.
What did you call it in bioweapon defense mode?
A bioweapon defense mode.
So does that mean it'll be good in a mustard gas attack?
In theory, yes. I mean, this is Tesla having a bit of fun. They also have a mode in these cars, in the Model X and the Model S, called ludicrous mode. Now, in the Model X, it enables you to get from 0 to 60 miles an hour in 2.8 seconds. Now, to give you some context, the Lamborghini Aventador SV does 0 to 62 in 2.8 seconds. It's that fast. Mm. Now, because this is an SUV, slightly bigger, with a 90 kilowatt hour battery, which is the same as the Model S is, it'll only do 0 to 60, I think, in 3.1, 3.2 seconds. But for a large SUV that can seat seven people, that's pretty good.
It is expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, we don't know how much it's going to cost around the world yet, but we suspect in Europe it's going to be in the region of sort of 60,000 euros, something like that. So it's definitely a premium car, as the Model S is, but thus far there seems to be no shortage of interest.
I mean, electric cars do seem to be becoming increasingly mainstream, don't they? We're seeing so many more models. I just walked by an MG outlet yesterday and I saw their latest offering. The thing is, I don't think I've ever seen a Tesla on the road. I mean, and they're not making any money, are they?
They're not making any money, and that's something that Tesla boss Elon Musk is always fairly candid about. But to be perfectly honest, it depends where you are in the world. There's lots of them on the streets of London. We're seeing more and more. Norway, there are huge incentives to buy electric cars. There are loads of them. I was actually out in Holland last week in the Netherlands and actually meeting up with Elon Musk and the opening of a new factory over there. A lot of Tesla taxis over there. So a lot of it depends on the incentives to buy electric cars. But certainly in the UK, they're very desirable as a thing on their own and they're selling very, very well. They're long waiting lists.
Steve Fowler there, Editor-in-Chief of Auto Express and Car Buyer, with Monocle's Tyke Enright on Thursday's edition of The Globalist. And finally here on The Recap, just time for a bit of a touch of luxury. Now this week, we were looking at some of the coming week's biggest stories from the luxury industry with regular Monocle 24 contributor Piers Schmidt. Here he caught up with Tom Edwards on Monday's edition of The Briefing.
I think nebulous is a great explanation of it, and vexed in the industry. For the longest time, the luxury industry has had a difficult relationship with the internet because, of course, the very essence of luxury in some respects is exclusivity, and the very notion of the internet is contrary to that. It's about access, it's about transparency, it's about giving people availability. So luxury has been wrestling with this whole relationship with the internet, and more importantly with the people that engage with luxury through the internet. So the hospitality industry in particular, through sites such as TripAdvisor, has struggled. You know, who are the people on TripAdvisor? Do we care about their opinion? Are they the people that really understand and appreciate luxury brands? But on the other hand, there's vast swathes of them all speaking to one another and creating brand reputation on the fly.
And I think that's really important because a lot of people, I mean, certainly it's a bit of a house view here at Monocle that, you know, there is quite a lot of white noise. You lack that editorial judgment, I suppose you'd call it, because of exactly that reason, you can't establish the provenance. Given that's the problem, what can be done about it?
Well, I think you have to accept and embrace that the biggest issue with TripAdvisor has always been you don't know who the person doing the reviewing is. I mean, you talk about it here at Midori House, I have the same thing. When you go abroad and you're spending precious, precious time, and often it is that time that's more valuable and important than actually the cash outlay, although that's not insignificant too when you're in the luxury business. But you look at these reviews and you do wonder, are they like me? Do they have the same experiences? Do they have the same needs and requirements? But that said, there's vast numbers of people there now who have made a decision to stay in the same place that you're about to decide to stay in. So at least that suggests that you are one and the same person.
So tell us a little bit about some brands that maybe sort of perform under these criteria. Are they the sorts that we would expect? Were there any surprises? What did you learn?
Well, an interesting insight was that it didn't seem to make much difference whether you were big or small, whether you did well. And by big, I mean how many hotels. So the Ritz, for example, has some 90 units around the world. Raffles Hotels, which came in third place after Oberoi in second, only 12. But consistency is key, whether you've got 3 or 300. Actually delivering, of course, a brand promise consistently around the world is everything. Amman was a surprise, number 43. And actually, when you dig deeper into the data, actually poor value for money is what's dragging Amman down. So yes, to the people that really can afford it, really appreciate it, those Amman junkies, it rates highly. But for other people who perhaps aspire to luxury, it doesn't rate so well on value for money.
Piers Schmidt there with Monocle's Tom Edwards with all you need to know about the week in luxury news. And that's just about it for this week's edition of The Recap. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and edited by Weidong Lin. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs from right across the schedule here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.